Good afternoon, it's 3 o'clock and you are tuned in to KTOO News in Juneau here on Wednesday the 25th of April, the year 2012. Jeff Brown with you here on a Juneau afternoon. Today we'll talk with Howard Weaver in town to sign copies of his new book, Write Hard, Die Free, and to speak for the Juneau World Affairs Council, both events happening tonight at the Nugget Mall. And Kim McNutt will update us on the 1 Million Bones Project. Eric Boris will fill us in on trail mix activities and we'll get a preview on next month's Juneau Jazz and Classics Festival. That writer's almanac, Bird Known Music, and more today on a Juneau afternoon. The forecast for tonight, increasing clouds, rain likely later on, low temperatures around 38 degrees. Forecast for Thursday looks like more rain likely with high temperatures around 53 degrees. Friday, it looks like mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain and high temperatures around 52 degrees.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The U.S. Department of Agriculture is holding tribal consultations in Alaska. The meetings are in response to President Obama's memorandum directing federal agencies to consult and collaborate with tribes across the country. Tiffany Zulkowski is with the USDA Rural Development in Alaska.
This is particularly important in Alaska because we receive a great amount of federal investment, especially per capita in comparison to other states, and we're also home to almost half of the federally recognized tribes in the country, and so we take that responsibility on, and really have been gearing these meetings to be more dialogue focused versus federal agencies going out presenting about what programs they have.
A first meeting was held earlier this month in Bethel in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta region. Zulkowski says many people were talking about challenges in their communities associated with housing, high costs of living, and access to affordable energy. And she says some raised concerns about maintaining a subsistence lifestyle with high energy costs.
One tribal leader discussed, you know, with expensive energy prices, you know, it could cost a hunter $1,000 to go out hunting for a moose, and then if they don't get anything to bring back to their family, they're out $1,000 and they haven't been able to put food on the table. So we really were listening to the tribal leaders to find out what are the specific needs that they have, and then really trying to identify how our programs could better fit into those communities.
Several federal agencies are taking part in the meetings, including the Department of Housing and Urban Development, the Small Business Administration, and the Department of Energy. A second meeting is taking place this week in Nome to meet with tribes in the Bering Straits region. A third meeting is being held in May in Ketchikan to meet with tribes of Southeast Alaska. A South Dakota college is hosting a conference on the 40th anniversary of the Wounded Knee Uprising. A man who provided legal services to some of those involved in the standoff says he's upset over one of the panels. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt reports.
The 1973 takeover at Wounded Knee on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation lasted for more than 2 months and resulted in at least 3 deaths. This weekend, Augustana College in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and the school's Center for Western Studies are sponsoring a 2-day conference, Wounded Knee 1973, 40 years later. Among the discussions is a panel on the investigations and prosecutions from the case, and that's upsetting an attorney for the defendants. Ken Tilson, legal coordinator for the Wounded Knee Legal Defense and Offense Committee, says he's bothered that there's no one from the defense on that panel. It includes assistant U.S. attorneys who prosecuted cases stemming from Wounded Knee and an FBI agent. Harry Thompson with Augustana's Center for Western Studies says many of the panelists asked to take part in the discussion. Thompson says anyone who wants to participate is welcome. The conference is set for Friday and Saturday in Sioux Falls. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellenbold.
A Mohawk man is awarded the Diamond Jubilee Medal. The medal was created for the 2012 celebrations of the 60th anniversary of Queen Elizabeth II's ascension to the throne as Queen of Canada. Peter Garrow was recently honored for his contributions to Native education. His work has been on the local and national level for First Nations. He's credited with establishing a successful education system at Akwesasne. On this day in 1914, Army Sergeant John Raymond Rice was born. The Ho-Chunk man was killed in action during the Korean War. Prior to joining the Army, Rice had served as a Marine during World War II. A national controversy sparked after a local cemetery in Sioux City, Iowa, ordered that Rice's body be disinterred after park officials and city leaders found he was Native American. President Truman ordered that Rice be buried between two generals at Arlington National Cemetery in Virginia. He was buried with full honors almost a year after his death. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Time is 3:06 and you are tuned in to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our first guest is author Howard Weaver. He's a former editor of the Anchorage Daily News. He's written a great new book called Write Hard, Die Free, Dispatches from the Battlefields and Barrooms of the Great Alaskan Newspaper War on Epicenter Press. He'll be making a presentation in front of the Juneau World Affairs Council tonight called The Facts Matter, 5 o'clock at the Nugget Mall, and he'll be doing a reading and book signing tonight at Hearthside Books in the Nugget Mall from 6:30 until 8 p.m. Howard Weaver, thank you so much for coming down to the station today and talking about your book.
No, I'm glad to do it. In a lot of ways, that story started in Juneau. Big parts of it started in Juneau, and I'm really glad to be back here.
Well, the book has been circulating around the newsroom, and the big question is, what was John Greeley like when he was growing up?
John Greeley was at least as nice a guy as he is now, and he might have been a more a meaner reporter, I don't know, but he and I kind of grew up together, so I guess we wouldn't necessarily have recognized all the changes in one another.
And this book is part autobiography, part an in-depth look at Alaskan journalism in the past 50 years.
Yeah, it's I picked a specific time period, and that was perhaps egocentrically me. I picked the time I went to work at the Daily News in 1972 until the Anchorage Times folded and in 92, and then I extended it 3 more years until I left the state to go out to California. But it was a very busy time in the Alaskan newspaper scene, that's for sure.
What drew you into the Alaskan newspaper business?
You know, I started in Anchorage. I'm a local boy. I was born in Anchorage, and so for me that was hometown. And I actually started when I was a junior in high school, covering high school sports stories for the Anchorage Daily News. And as I recall, I didn't make a lot of money doing that, but they put my name in the paper, and I really liked that.
Early on in your career, you got a Pulitzer Prize.
You know, it was amazing, and the Pulitzer Prize actually came. The first one at the Daily News came in 1976, which was a year I was living in Juneau and covering the legislature, and somehow Kay Fanning, the owner and publisher of the Daily News, knew in advance, I guess, that we were likely to get it because she'd arranged for me to fly up to Anchorage on some pretext, and so I was in Anchorage when we heard about it, and I have to tell you, frankly, I did not know that was the day the Pulitzer Prizes were going to be announced. I didn't know that we had entered. I certainly had no suspicion that we would win, and so it's one of those rare moments in life where something absolutely marvelous happens and catches you completely unaware.
Want to give us some background on what you were nominated and won for?
Well, it was the Public Service Prize, which is given to the institution, so there were two of us who worked on it mostly. At the time, we were looking into the Alaska Teamsters Union, which I think, and I believe you can justify, was certainly one of the most powerful institutions in the state at that point. The pipeline was gearing up. It was clear there were going to be tens of thousands of workers. Jess Carr and the Teamsters represented a lot of them, and they were really becoming very wealthy and very powerful in a state where there wasn't a lot of concentrated wealth or power. And so we decided just to try and put some dimensions on that. You know, we didn't set out looking for nefarious wrongdoings or anything else, although we were young reporters and we'd have been happy to find as much as we could. But the real accomplishment of the series, I think, was that it illuminated something that had been in the darkness before. And so Alaskans could say, whoa, it is big, but it's not limitlessly big. We can now see what it is and how it's going to affect us.
So this is the late 70s, and we're talking about the Anchorage Daily News and also the Anchorage Times. The Great Alaskan Newspaper War, it's just sometimes you really make it sound like a war.
Well, it felt like a war to me, I have to say. You know, pretty much every day of my adult life, I got up and went to work wondering, how can we beat the Anchorage Times? It was a constant presence. The news ecosystem was much smaller in those days. You know, we certainly didn't have anything remotely like the Internet or even like cable TV. And so the two newspapers in Anchorage loomed very large, and the Times especially so, because it was vastly the bigger paper, the more influential paper, the older paper, had been founded since 1915, the Daily News wasn't founded until 1947 or something like that. So the Times had all the advantages, it would seem, and we felt like we were on a crusade.
And the Times and the Daily News, and it looks like the Daily News won.
It did win, and it's part of what makes this story, I think, of interest to journalists elsewhere, and I hope other people, but it was such an unlikely victory. It's really fair, I think, to think of it as David and Goliath, at least the way it started.
One of the my passages in the book that I especially like was when you went into the bar and kind of hustled by the I'm not sure, the labor leader.
I think that was the guy that had been identified to me as an organized crime associate from Arizona. I was a very young reporter then. I got to tell you, I look back on some of that and wonder what I was thinking. Someone asked me once, very recently, if I had been scared during this period of my life when I was covering crime and the Teamsters and whatever. And basically, the answer is no, I wasn't scared. And the more I learn about it subsequently, the more I think maybe I ought to have been scared. One of those two guys that I was following, I just heard, recently died in prison where he was serving time for murder. So I didn't check that out. I don't know for sure if it's true, but it made an impression on me.
What led to the eventual downfall of the Times?
Really good question. It's nuanced, of course, and there are lots of factors. But I think probably the most significant thing was they lost touch with the audience. They had been in power so long that they thought whatever they did was right. And instead of, you know, kind of responding to the community as a good news organization will, they saw themselves as directing the community. And maybe it was in some ways generational, too. The Daily News was not just younger in terms of years, but I think more representative of the kind of people who were moving into Alaska at that point, people who had a genuine interest in the environment, in quality of life, in opportunities. And the Times was very much, an old-school, downtown establishment newspaper. There's a quote in the book that I was stunned when I found it. It wasn't made to me, but Robert Atwood, the owner of the Times in 1975 or something, gave an interview to some reporters who were doing a book that turned into Lost Frontier. And he actually told them, we don't report the arrests of professional people. We give them the soft treatment. And, you know, for somebody like me, that was just like waving a red flag.
It was well known as the mouthpiece of the industry.
Well, it was a very pro-oil paper, no question about it. Mr. Atwood had gotten some oil leases himself before Prudhoe Bay down on the Kenai Peninsula and was just a champion of oil. I wrote in the book that the Times had always been a vocal advocate for oil, and then, of course, in its last years, it became more or less a wholly owned subsidiary of oil when it was run by Bill Allen.
How did that change the paper?
Well, the first thing it did was inject a whole lot of money in it. And Bill Allen bought that paper with the stated intention of killing off the Daily News. And you got to take a guy like that seriously. And he had a lot of money. He had just made a lot of money earlier that same year cleaning up the Exxon Valdez oil spill. So his pockets are full of this money that he made for that. We are a thorn in the side of his big clients, the oil companies. He intended to, you know, sort of crush us. And so they spent a lot of money. I don't know how much money they spent in the 2 years that they tried, but it was in the tens of millions of dollars for sure. Hiring staff, making the paper fatter, redesigning it, make it look much more professional, and a lot of the things they did made it a better newspaper.
Selling ads in a questionable way?
Well, they had relationships that I would question, at least. There were a lot of ads in the Times that nobody knew came from oil companies, because what they did was they would buy ads on behalf of nonprofits in the community, people like the shelter or the Boys and Girls Club, something like that. And it just looked like, you know, ads promoting really good works. In fact, it was almost all paid for by ARCO. And so it was a way, undoubtedly legal, I don't mean to suggest it was illegal, but it was certainly misleading. And it was a way for there to be lots of oil money pumped into the Times that very few people were aware of.
Talking to Howard Weaver, former editor of the Anchorage Daily News. He's got a book called Write Hard, Die Free. He'll be doing a presentation tonight for the Regional World Affairs Council at 5 o'clock in the Nugget Mall. He'll also be signing and reading from his book tonight at 6:30 till 8 o'clock at Hearthside Books, also in the Nugget Mall. We talked about John Greeley at the very beginning of the interview, but didn't get much further. Tell me about the Alaska Advocate.
You know, the Advocate really was born in Juneau. John and I were both covering the Alaska legislature. He was the main voice of news out of the legislature as the AP correspondent here. And I got to know him, and we got to talking, and we really were talking about how we thought journalism didn't really reflect, you know, the reality that we were seeing and the interests of our generation. We wanted to try a different way to tell those stories, a way with maybe more voice, with more attitude, if you will. And we sat around and talked about it, and less than a year later, we actually started this little weekly newspaper. There were four of us initially. Each one of us kicked in $1,250, which was what we could afford, and so we had $5,000. And we managed to make that last for 2.5 years, and I'm very proud of that, and very proud of some of the journalism we did as well.
As well as blowing out the pipeline.
Well, you know, it was vulnerable, so somebody had to.
Tell me a little bit more about that, so our listeners don't feel like I actually did blow up the pipeline.
No, we didn't. But what happened was, during the first Gulf War, I think it was, the Times ran a banner story saying the pipeline is safe from sabotage. And I didn't even know anybody had been talking about that, but it seemed self-evidently wrong. How could you guard 800 miles of pipe running through an isolated wilderness? And so to test that theory, a couple of people from the Advocate, Roger Painter and Ken Roberts, went up to the pipeline where it crosses the road at Glen Allen and walked in a little ways and stood beside the pipeline and blew off a red smoke grenade and just stood there for a while until all the smoke was gone, and then they drove away, and nobody ever said a word to them. So we felt like we had maybe done a public service, you know, here saying, look, it's not as secure as people say it is. And, of course, the Times and the oil companies didn't see it that way.
Very Hard, Die Free. It's a great book on how it's not only a history lesson, but also it's a lesson in Alaska newspaper politics and more.
When you write about journalism, you get to write about a lot of things, politics, public policy, community activities, interesting, colorful people. It was a great time to be a journalist, and I'm glad to have gotten a chance to write about it.
Howard, thank you so much for being on the show today. Anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
No, as I said, I'm really happy to be here, and it feels still like Juneau, and it feels like home. Thanks.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 25th of April, 2012. It's the birthday of the poet Ted Kooser, born Ames, Iowa, 1939, who said, I had a wonderfully happy childhood. He started writing poetry seriously as a teenager. He said, I was desperately interested in being interesting. Poetry seemed a way of being different. Went to college, flunked out of grad school, took the first job he was offered at a life insurance company, worked there for 35 years. Ted Kooser says, I believe that writers write for perceived communities. I worked every day with people who didn't read poetry, who hadn't read it since they were in high school, and I wanted to write for them. So, every morning he got up at 4:30, made a pot of coffee, wrote until 7, then he put on his suit and his tie, and he went to work. It's the birthday of Howard R. Garris, born in Binghamton, New York, 1873, who gave us Uncle Wiggily, the old rabbit in the suit and the top hat. Garris was a reporter for the Newark Evening News. He wrote hundreds of children's books, published his first Uncle Wiggily story in a newspaper in 1910. It was so popular, he ended up writing an Uncle Wiggily story 6 days a week for more than 30 years. Howard R. Garris said, half the fun of nearly everything is thinking about it beforehand or afterward. It's the birthday of Ella Fitzgerald, Newport News, Virginia, 1917. When she was 16, she entered a contest at the Apollo Theater in Harlem, walked on stage wearing ragged clothes, men's boots. She sang The Object of My Affection, won the contest. Soon she was fully employed in the nightclubs of New York. Ella Fitzgerald, who said, the only thing better than singing is more singing. And it's the birthday of Paget Powell, born Gainesville, Florida, 1952. Went to college, studied chemistry, spent 8 years as a roofer in Texas, working on a novel on the side. His latest book comes out this summer, You and Me. Here's a poem by Ted Kooser on his birthday, a poem entitled How to Foretell a Change in the Weather. Rain, always follows the cattle sniffing the air and huddling in fields with their heads to the lee. You will know that the weather is changing when your sheep leave the pasture too slowly and your dogs lie about and look tired, when the cat turns her back to the fire, washing her face, and the pigs wallow in litter. Cocks will be crowing at unusual hours, flapping their wings. Hens will chant. When your ducks and your geese are too noisy, and the pigeons are washing themselves, when the peacocks squall loudly from the tops of the trees, when the guinea fowl grates, when sparrows chip loudly and fuss in the roadway, and when swallows fly low skimming the earth, when the carrion crow croaks to himself, and wild fowl dip and wash, and when moles throw up hills with great fervor, when toads creep out in numbers, when frogs croak, when bats enter the houses, when birds begin to seek shelter, and the robin approaches your house, when the swan flies at the wind and your bees leave the hive, when ants carry their eggs to and fro, and flies bite, and the earthworm is seen on the surface of things. How to Foretell a Change in the Weather by Ted Kooser, from Flying at Night, published by University of Pittsburgh Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, celebrating 100 years of discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. And by CenturyLink, linking Americans and Fortune 500 companies to what matters most. Learn more at CenturyLink.com. Edited by Noah Smith, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Time is 3:22, and you are tuned to KTVO News in Juneau here on a June afternoon. Our next guest is N.K. McNaughton, here to talk about recap of the One Man's Bone Project, a film art installation happening this Saturday, the 28th of April at 4 p.m. in Marine Park. Last week, we were here talking about the Mr. Bones Project. MK, thank you for coming down again today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So, a recap of the general idea?
The idea is something that Naomi Natal came up with, an artist. I'm not sure where she's from, but she came up with the idea to make 1 million bones as a collaborative installation to lay in the National Mall in Washington, D.C. next spring of 2013. And she's trying to raise awareness of genocide throughout the world and throughout history. She's trying to prevent future genocide from developing, saying, let's take a stand. And she had the thought that if we had taken all the victims from Rwanda and laid them in the street in D.C., would our nation have had a different response? And so that's what she's trying to do with art. And the idea spoke to me. I thought, I can help with this. She wanted to have an installation in every state capital on the 28th of April. So that's coming up this Saturday. And in order to get ready for that, we made a bunch of bones.
Your goal was 2,500 bones. How many did you make at all?
I think maybe 600 bones. They're kind of stacked up in my boiler room drying right now. The plaster and the paper mache was a little bit goopy, so I'm drying them before I count them. It's an impressive pile, and if the weather cooperates, I'll do some more on Friday, and I'll send out a quick Facebook blast inviting people to come Friday afternoon in the sun and make more. And Saturday, we're going to lay them down on the dock.
And is it Marine Park?
It's at Marine Park on the dock, and we'll just meet there on the dock. I will be there with the bones, and people can just join me. And Ryan Cortez Perez is going to film the installation for us, and Floridolino Lagandino has very generously offered to take photos as well. So we have two fabulous documentarians.
Close enough.
Yeah. And we'll just lay them down in create, it's symbolic of a mass grave, a way to commemorate victims and to make a visible petition for change in the future. And the thing, one of the things I love about this project is that our bones are all the same after we're gone. You can't tell people apart. There's no skin color, no difference in accent or where you grew up. Our bones are the same. So we'll be laying them all down Saturday at 4:00. You can meet at Marine Park, and the artist has asked that people wear kind of neutral clothing so it doesn't compete with the installation. So just something black or brown or simple without a lot of graphics on it. So you don't look more interesting than the art installation in the film. No need for heels and pearls and bright colors. Just something muted, jeans, black shirt, something like that.
Is there a website that talks more about the project?
There is, 1millionbones.org. And I wanted to say that Goldstein Improvement Company really generously donated money to help pay for all the art supplies. The plaster is pretty expensive. So they that was huge, huge help that they made that possible. Supplied us with great art supplies, Goldstein Improvement Company. And also there is a national organization, relief organization, CARES, that is going to donate $1 for every artwork bone that's made. When we're done with our installation, we'll mail the bones in to Washington, D.C. And CARE is giving $1 for every bone, up to $500,000, to relief work in Somalia and the Democratic Republic of Congo. That's exciting collaboration.
I'll say, so if you need more information about this, you can check out the Facebook site here and locally as well as the national website.
Yep. Both Facebook and the website are 1 Million Bones.
All right. And the video is going to get shot this Saturday at 4 p.m. in Marine Park.
So please join me and bring friends. I knew that I'd have people show up for the making of the bones because that's a fun art project. And I'm more concerned that I won't have enough people in the film. I don't want it to be a film of me. I want to have a lot of people with me. So it's a chance to make a stand and talk about how our media can be strong and we can offer support to other parts of the world through an art and a media-based project.
How many bone makers did you have with you on Sunday?
I've worked in several classrooms. So on Sunday, I think I had about 150 people come through from age 3 through people in their 60s, good age range. I think I've had about 200 people help make bones so far, which is really a wonderful contribution from Juno.
If you'd like to be part of the action, go to the Marine Park this Saturday, the 28th of April at 4 p.m., and take part in 1 Million Bones. Okay, thank you so much for coming down. Anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
No. People can feel free to contact me, though, to mcmac@gci.net. If you have questions.
Thanks for coming by.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Clay Good. I'm hosting the next event in the KRNN Concert Series April 25th at 7 p.m. at the Goldtown Theater. Ed Littlefield and Christian Fabian will perform original music they call Native Jazz. Fusing traditional clinket and European melodies with jazz to create a totally unique sound, both are professional musicians, composers, and performers. This is a show you definitely won't want to miss. April 25th at the Goldtown Theater. Tickets at krnn.org, the station, or at the door.
Some of the music of Ed Littlefield and friends. Time is 3:29, and you are tuned to KTUO Juno. The studio with us now is Eric Boris, the executive director of Trail Mix, here to talk about Trail Mix's upcoming season. Eric, thank you for coming down to the station today.
Thank you for having me, Jeff.
For people who don't know, tell us about Trail Mix, please.
We are a trail-building nonprofit in Juneau. We build and maintain trails in and around the area. So most of the trails you've seen, other than the direct Forest Service ones, we've had something to do with them.
How many members do you have?
We have about 500 or so members of the community.
And volunteers?
Hopefully all of them volunteer at some point or another, but we have several volunteer days throughout the year. And, we probably have the 40, 50, 60 people show up at different times for different things.
What kind of different types of trails do you take part in?
What kind of trails? Well, we do everything from building wide gravel bike paths like the Under Thunder Trail, which we built a couple of years ago, which is designed for two-way traffic of bikes, to little narrow mountain trails like the Mount Juno Trail we're going to be rerouting this summer.
What's the step in building a trail?
Depends on what you're going across. First thing you got to do is figure out what's underneath the trail, or what you're going to be putting it on. So around Juneau, we've got a lot of really mucky areas, so we have to put down fill to make it stable, to make it sustainable, because everything we build, we want it to be there from 100 years from now. So if we're going through a muskeg, we will build a framework, called turnpike, of natural logs that then hold in gravel that we bring in and pack down. So by the time the logs rot away, the gravel is part of the surface, and it should be there for a long time.
The process of rebuilding a trail if it needs it?
Depends on what's there again. There's a lot of old boardwalk around here, and we like to get that out because that's slippery and it's hard to maintain. So we'll take that out and put in something harder, or a lot of areas. A lot of what we do is rerouting around eroded areas and try and route trails in such a way that they do not erode again in the future.
One of my favorite trails is the Basin Road Trail. If not, then my favorite trail is a favorite of many others. What's the status of that, especially the trestle leading up to the trail itself?
The trestle should be reopened on the 1st of this month. I don't think they're completely finished. I think they're going to have to do it again, work on it again next year, but you should have access again after the 1st.
For vehicles?
For vehicles as well, I believe, yeah. That's what I've been told.
All right.
Yeah.
What are some of the trails you're working on?
We're also working on the Outer Point Trail. I'm excited about that one because we're going to make it accessible for wheelchairs. We're going to try and get people that have limited mobility able to get down to the water and harden a campsite there for them, and bring it up to the standard of the Rainforest Trail, which is right next door to it. So to get rid of the old boardwalk, put in some turnpike, make it nicer. And we're working on the Mount Juno Trail, which I already mentioned. We're going to reroute the top of that because right now it just kind of goes straight up the side of the mountain. We're going to put in a few long curves in there, so and some switchbacks, so it'll be a little easier on the knees coming down.
How long of a process is that?
That's going to be, we're going to have a crew of probably about 8 up there camped out for 2 months. They're going to camp out at the top for 4 days at a time and be hacking away with pickaxes and Pulaskis for a long time, so.
Pulaski?
Pulaski's it's a wildland firefighting tool. It's a cross between an axe and it's not really an adze, but it's a grubbing tool. So you've got an axe on one side and then a pickmatic on the other side, so you can tear away at roots and dirt. Yeah, it's a tool we use often. And we're also working. We're going to try and expand the Under Thunder Trail. We're going to continue that along, and we're working on the Peterson Lake Trail with the Forest Service. So we're going to improve that.
Guess the work never stops when trails are a fun thing to do.
It never stops. Yeah. By the time you finally fix a trail, you wait 40 years, and it'll need work again. And that's what most of what we're doing these days is just maintaining things that have been around for a long time.
40 years, that's a pretty substantial length of time.
Yeah, well, if you look at the Treadwell Ditch Trail, it's been around for 100 years, and all that needs is some bridges to make that work again. We're working on that, too.
So if people would like to help out, what's the phone number they can call to find out more about these work parties?
They can call 790-6406, or they can email at info@junotrails.org, or we can be found on the web at www.junotrails.org.
Eric Boris, thank you for coming down the station again.
Thank you for having me, Jeff.
This is Bird Note. At this time of year,
a very young male Buick Wren is beginning to learn how to sing. Like a human baby, he'll babble while he experiments with sounds and learns how to organize phrases. The young Buick Wren is listening to the song of his father, who sings a crisp, well-defined song, separated by pauses. Now, let's compare. Here's the song of our young Buick Wren. It's fuzzy, unfocused, a little rambling. Here's the adult male again. It's fully developed and unique to that male. Each adult male Buick Wren has his own set of songs. A young wren grows up learning his father's songs. But when it matures and moves to its own new territory, it will leave behind the song of its father to create a song that sounds more like its new neighbors. BirdNote would like to thank avian communication expert Donald Kruzma for his research on the Buick Wren. You'll find a link to his work at birdnote.org.
some of the music from Barney McClure, one of the featured performers this year at the Juno Jazz and Classics Festival. In the studio with us to talk about it are Jess Lindwintala and also Linda Rosenthal from the festival itself. Thank you, everybody, for coming down the station today.
Hey, thanks for having us, Jeff. Hi, Jeff. Our pleasure.
So this is coming up May 4th through the 19th. Sounds like an exciting time. You all ready for it?
We're ready.
As ready
yes.
can be.
Yeah, we are. We're excited, yeah.
How did it get started?
Well, you know, starting a festival, having a festival in Juneau had been a dream of mine forever, you know, ever since I came here. I just, and having been to many festivals myself, I've just said it has to happen here. And I just have had this, that dream, and it was the realization of a dream. And happily, there were many others, musicians, many members, just people in the community, community leaders, and, other people who felt the same way, and a group of us got together, and we met in October of 1986, and we launched our very first festival in 1987, May of 87, and we've been going every May since then. For this will be our 26th year.
How did you get the idea to mix peanut butter and jelly or jazz and classics?
The jazz and classics,
mm-hmm.
Nuss of it. Oh well, Well, first of all, I had been to festivals that included both jazz and classical music, and I loved the mix. It was just, everything just seemed to spark, you know, when the two genres got to, were either on the same night, or the musicians were just mixing and, you know, trying and just talking about music. It was, you know, it was wonderful socially, and it was wonderful musically, and the audiences seemed to love it. It seems like there was a real crossover in audiences and a great, just an enthusiasm for those two genres. And then we added blues a little bit later with the Blues Cruises, and the festival started with those two genres in mind. We found this great name for it, but knew all along that it would be a jazz and classical festival.
Some memorable moments you've had?
The one just still very, very fresh in my mind was the year that Brubeck came, and actually that was our second year. It was 1988. We were in the high school out of Juneau, the Juneau Douglas High School Auditorium. It was a packed house. We sold every seat and then some. And I don't think anybody was really expecting this, but when he walked out on stage, there was this deafening roar and a spontaneous standing ovation. He was shocked. He was just dumbfounded at this reception. And it was just... just the beginning to a totally magical experience for everybody. There were other times, like when we played, we had the Ursa Major Strings play out at the Nugget Falls at the Glacier. That was memorable. It was a sunny day. 200 people hiked out to the spot where we played, and the kids came in on war canoes. And, this is just such a Juneau thing to happen. I think it's those memories that are just the most vivid to me are those that are just inseparable, the Juneau and the musicness of it all. And those were my most vivid memories, just two of them, yeah.
What goes into your selection process?
Well, first and foremost, of course, is that the artistry, you know, that the musicians that I select are just highest caliber possible, you know, that I can find, and that goes without saying. But then they have to not just like teaching and playing for kids and interacting with communities. They have to actually actively love it. that's a very, very important consideration, and because that's so much a part of what we do, you know, so much we have evening concerts, main stage concerts, but so much of what we do are informal concerts, school concerts, the concerts at the state office building, and just at, you know, venues that were intimate venues, and just so much of it is interacting with the community and audiences.
I like the brown bags at the State Office Building in the Nugget Mall because you're bringing classical music and jazz music to people who might not normally expect it at that particular
exactly.
location.
Yeah, yeah. We like to reach into the community. We like to go to our audiences and have these concerts and music, great music in unexpected places. Exactly.
Let's start with a little bit of a rundown of who's going to be here this year.
Well, this is a really, really special year. Taj Mahal is opening the festival, and we're just thrilled to have him just in our presence. It just adds a special luster to the festival this year to have a musical icon like that. After Taj, so he on the 4th, we opening night is next Friday night.
Is that concert sold out?
That concert actually is sold out, but we are telling people to show up at the door at 7 o'clock, an hour before the show starts, and get your name on the wait list, and probably we'll be able to accommodate most people, everybody, cool. We hope.
So there's always been those people that buy tickets and just find other reasons to miss it. And so that takes care of blues and a little bit of jazz with Taj Mahal. What's next?
Right, and then the next day we have a really neat classical event. It's at the Shrine of St. Therese. This is the second year we're doing that. It's, as everybody knows, been there, a magical setting, and just the combination of the music, the gorgeousness of the setting, and it's just it's a very, very special event, and it's intimate. It only holds 100 people, so we're having two shows, one at 4 and one at 6:30, and those tickets, I think, are really selling rapidly, too, so folks might want to get a ticket before that one. Those are sold out also, and that will be with the Avalon String Quartet and with my husband, Paul, joining them playing viola, and it's a great program, Mozart and Ravel. The next day we have the Hot Club of Cowtown. Now that's another group that has been here. They were here with the Folk Festival, I think, about 10 years ago, and I just had no idea actually how popular they were and remain. People are so excited that they're coming back. That was a nice unexpected surprise, actually. I mean, I've known about them for a long time, and just didn't realize they had such a huge Juno following, but that's going to be an exciting event, and that's at Hope Hall, the old A&B Hall.
You brought a CD with you of featuring some classical music. Who are we featuring next? The CD,
yes, actually, that is one movement from the Mozart Quintet, the Viola Quintet, that will be played on Saturday out at the Shrine. It's the Mozart Viola Quintet, movement.
Start with a little bit of that.
Okay,
now.
Great. Thank you.
listening to one of the highlights of the Jazz and Classics Festival. It's going to be performed at the Shrine. I was going to say the Shrine Auditorium, but it's not the Shrine Auditorium. It's the Shrine of St. Louis. In the studio with us now is Linda Roosevelt and Jesselyn Rintala from the Juno Jazz and Classics organization. Remind me, who's going to be performing at this at the Shrine?
The Shrine will be the Avalon String Quartet and Paul Rosenthal on viola.
And what other classical concerts can people expect this year?
The other concerts, the Avalons will be doing their own concert on Thursday, May 10th. That will be at the Holy Trinity Episcopal Church, and that's an all Beethoven program. We did an all Beethoven program last year, and it was such a huge success. We're doing three different Beethoven quartets, and they're just it's going to be a wonderful, wonderful program. I mean, there's just nothing like an evening of all Beethoven. It's he's a great, great guy to spend time with.
Should we feature a little bit more of Beethoven?
Sure, yeah. This is the string quartet, Opus 18, number 4.
Time is 3:30:52, and you are tuned in to KTUO News in Juneau. Listen to a little bit of Beethoven here and getting ready for the Jazz and Classics Festival coming up right around the corner, May 4th through the 19th. What other classical concerts can we expect, Linda? Also, a special marine band concert.
Right. Well, the other classical concert, first of all, we have Putin on the Ritz, which is just a combination of both jazz and classical music. The first half will be Jeffrey Solo, Paul Rosenthal, I'll be playing on that one, and Yoni Levyatov on piano, and Barney McClure doing the whole second half, the jazz set. And then on the 17th, we have an all Shostakovich program that's called The Genius of Shostakovich, and that's going to be like the Beethoven program. Just here we have Beethoven, the genius of his time and all time, and Shostakovich, the genius of the last century and probably for all time, too. So that's a program with the cello sonata, the piano trio, and some solo piano works, the preludes and fugues. And that's with Paul and Yoni and Jeffrey Solo. And then I would like to add, there's one group that has just joined the roster so recently, it didn't make it on the ticket mailer, on our brochure. So I want to be sure to mention the President's Own U.S. Marine Band Jazz Combo. They were here in 2007, and they're wonderful. They're going to play a noon concert on the 14th at the State Office Building, and then again later that afternoon at 5, and that will be at the JAC, at the Arts and Cultural Center. The first one is called Jazz Meets Rock, and the second show will be focused on jazz meets funk. Anyway, they're going to be here the whole week. They'll be playing in the schools and just becoming embedded in the community and playing all over town and doing workshops and just adding, I think, a lot to our jazz offering, of course, and to the whole festival. They're just terrific.
If you're trying to follow along by looking at a calendar, don't bother. Go to the Jazz and Classics website. Jesselyn, do you want to remind us of the website, please?
Sure. That's www.jazzandclassics.org. So jazzandclassics.org.
And you have special package deals available?
We do. If you're an avid Jazz and Classics fan or if you're interested in some of these amazing sellout shows that Linda's just been talking about, we offer package deals this year. We call them the Trio, the Take 5, and the Major 7. So if you're going to 3, 5, or 7 of our shows, be sure to check out our ticket packages. We'll get you up to 15% off to get you in the door to a number of these amazing artists and venues and performances.
lots of other things going on. We forgot the Honey Drops.
Oh, the California Honey Drops. Now, they're our young up-and-coming group. Their career is absolutely skyrocketing. They've only been together for 4 years. They're a young band out of Oakland. That's our blues band, officially. I mean, they're our band on the blues cruises, and they will be performing on land May 11th. And they're performing at Hope Hall. And those tickets really... They're selling rapidly, too, and this is a wonderful, what can I say, danceable party group. They're terrific. It's a group. It's a band of five, and they're multi-instrumentalists. They play, two of them play the horn, guitar. They all sing, so the harmonies are fabulous, and I think that's a group not to be missed.
And Skillet Liquors?
Oh, LaVey Smith and her Red Hot Skillet Liquors. Yeah, that's another band. It's really a swing band. You know, music from the 30s and 40s. LaVey is the vocalist, and the band just by itself is a standout. It's I think there are four horns, and then so that one also has a substantial horn section and bass, piano, and drums. And LaVey, it's a terrific, again, danceable, and opening night, the Honey Drops, and LaVey, closing night, these are all dances, and LaVey is just going to be another big party.
You get your tickets online by going to www.jazzandclassics.org. Sounds like a lot of excitement, and it's too much for us to fit in the rest of the show, so I want to invite you to come back and later on in the month here, maybe early part of next month, to talk more about the Juno Jazz and Classics Festival.
Great. We'd love to come back, Jeff, and thanks for having us today.
It's great. Thank you.
So we want to welcome everybody to the legendary Continental Club tonight here in South Austin, Texas. We're very, very excited about having the Hot Club of Cowtown here. Always a pleasure to work with. On bass, we have Jake. On guitar, Witt. And the lovely Alana here on fiddle. Put your hands together for the Hot Club of Cowtown.
Time is 3:58 and you are tuned in to KTLO News in Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. KTUO also broadcasts on these translators. The Valley and Knock Bay area, tune to K276 AF at 103.1. Lemon and Swartz Creek, K269 AO at 101.7. Stavis listens on K201 AM 88.1. K220 BT serves Huna at 91.9. We're switching in another nice straight here, KTUO on K210 AS 89.9. Also live online at www.ktuo.org. If you'd like to get tickets to any of the Jazz and Classics event, go to their website, www.jazzandclassics.org. Well, next is All Things Considered. Thank you for tuning in to Juneau Afternoon today, and have a great evening.